The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
What is your game plan? What is your strategy? My attitude towards the markets is a little bit like my attitude towards coronavirus. I'm not inclined to shut myself in. I'm inclined to figure out what the best strategy is. If there's some practical things that can be done, then by all means, we'll get that done. But not to live in fear or panic, just to make sure you're implementing an excellent and well-thought-out plan.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, you've quoted this before, David. Someone once said there are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen. And then I'm going to just add to that, because even today, there are seconds where days happen. And, you know, what we saw with the Federal Reserve yesterday, we could have predicted was coming, because the markets right now are starting to realize they were overvalued. They were realizing that long before. Now the coronavirus has become an excuse for the Federal Reserve to do what they probably were going to have to do anyway.
Well, and we know that they can do more. They can monetize assets, and that is kind of one of the last bullets that they have. They're taking rates near zero, and, you know, with the 50 basis point cut this week, it does leave them with very limited options, but they can expand the balance sheet. They're currently buying $60 billion in assets a month. And so let your imagination run. Is there a number that represents shock and awe in the 21st century?
And I wonder if people are going to cry out for the very thing that they would have cried about earlier. You know, now people seeing the stock market falling going, give us negative rates,
right.
Give us negative rates. You know, this basis cut, this 50 basis point cut yesterday reminded me of what Tomas Sedlacek told us a few years ago. He said, you know, the new religion and the new priests of that religion have to do with perpetual growth. And that's what we've had with the central bankers continually adding to this market. And this high priesthood of this new religion of perpetual growth are the central bankers. Anything they say or do seems to be a little bit like the priests of old. In a way, they offered a sacrifice to that god yesterday, and the stock market suddenly reversed and went up. It didn't last, but it reversed and went up.
One of the more interesting aspects of dinner table conversation this week has been, again, just sort of taking away some of the tragic elements of people dying hither and yon relating to the coronavirus, and just looking at things from a political or social perspective and seeing that insecurity is something that allows for significant controls to be put in place. If you look in China, the use of technology, The Economist had a couple of excellent articles on the use of technology, the expansion of technology and drone technology and QR codes for each person, where, you know, you're either a green, a yellow, or a red.
And the drones will chase you if you're a red. We saw that video of that poor Chinese lady. She obviously was not supposed to be out of her house.
Listen,
and the drone
chased her and
yelled
at her. I'd be running, too, if I had a drone yelling at me in Chinese. And there's nothing like being berated by a machine. So I think the social aspects are interesting, because there is a certain, if you tell us that something is very, very wrong and there's nothing we can do about it, then we kind of roll over and so just say, well, then help us solve the problem.
Right.
And that could be central banks doing that. That could be politicians doing that. That could be the CDC and the World Health Organization doing that.
Have you noticed the articles coming out about global governance saying, you know, we have to somehow do this all at once for everyone?
Well, so this week, it's no surprise that we need to coordinate efforts. The G7 puts their heads together, and this is what precedes, at least in a sequence of events, the announcement by Jerome Powell of a 50 basis point cut. So you've got coronavirus concerns. We go from meltdown last week to melt up this week. And then, of course, not a lot of follow through. If you watch the markets immediately following the 50 basis point cut, it really wasn't that impressive if you're looking at stocks. So speculators are caught. They've been caught in the last week or so with too much exposure. And if you're reflecting on last week and the week before, there was this belief that more was visible on the horizon than actually was. So we see the future, and the future is bright. And then all of a sudden, stock prices start going down, treasury prices start going up, and we've got last week's constant stream of liquidations, which only let up very bizarrely in the last 10 minutes of trading on Friday.
Yeah, but then, of course, Japan had to open up before the Dow on Monday. And Japan, I heard they added $101 billion to their market. They just came up with that money out of thin air to keep it from collapsing.
It was the largest quantitative easing program directly put to Japanese equities on record. And yeah, so you know, you look and you say, well, they are, call them external in their pronouncements. Yes, this is the government buying. But who was buying late Friday? Was that all organic buying at the end of a long week? Here we are at the end of the month, the end of the week. You know, no particular reason to paint the tape. And yet we are down over 1,000 points. And in about a 5 to 10 minute period, we march back 650 points of that loss. And it's a very modest loss by the end of the week, at least for that day, relative to other days in the week.
Well, lest we talk just about stocks. I mean, the debt markets are actually the real story right now.
Yeah, our colleague Doug Nolan notes that stocks are actually the sideshow. You've got the corporate debt markets last week, which were seizing, and credit default swaps, which began to march higher. And the real concern is the plumbing that supports global liquidity was under acute pressure. And so, yeah, you end up seeing the signs and symptoms of that in the stock market, and that gets most of the headlines. But, you know, what we're looking at is not unlike the fourth quarter of 2018. Equity weakness was symptomatic of liquidity seizure.
And it's good for us to remember, we've been talking since September of the repo market, you know, just this massive liquidity that's going into the repo market. 80% of U.S. treasuries have been purchased by the Fed, you know, since September. And then, of course, we have quantitative easing. That started in October. This is long before the coronavirus scare.
Yeah, I think to get the Fed committee out and active and, you know, lowering an emergency cut 50 basis points this week, it suggests that there are players in the financial universe that are under real existential pressure. The U.S. economy is still fine. They're willing to say, look, there's no issues there. We don't see any issues there, but we are concerned about what may be.
How about the repo market?
And that's, I think, where you begin to see, again, signs of cracks, of real concerns between counterparties. The repo market was more oversubscribed on Tuesday than any other day yet. And that's saying a lot. So, you know, you're basically looking at overnight lending between banks, which was not going to function on a normal basis without the Fed backstop. And then repo oversubscribed, the largest yet. What does that mean? I tell you, it means something significant.
And I wonder, Dave, if what we're seeing is the second chapter of 2011. Okay, because in 2011, if you remember the summer of 2011, we had the potential that the European Union was going to just completely break apart. We had gold topping $900 an ounce. And then this guy named Mario Draghi, an Italian, came out, a Goldman Sachs Italian, let's just put it that way. He came out and he said, we will do whatever it takes. That's the high priestly gown of the central banker. They did whatever it took. Did they delay? Are we just seeing a continuation of 2011 without him saying that?
It's like 2011, but in some respects, it's more like 2008 and 2009. I think what the Fed's trying to do is draw from Draghi's playbook and say, look, if we can restore calm, great. But what they haven't allowed to occur is enough water to go under the bridge. If you go back to 2008 and 2009 and then play the tape back between then and 2011, I mean, you're talking about stress and strain in Greece and in Cyprus and, you know, a virtual collapse.
It was tense.
You know, so all of those things were happening prior to the whatever it takes. Here we've got a couple percentage points off of all-time highs in the stock market. And yes, I think if you're looking at the liquidity plumbing, that's where there's more concern. But it's almost like they're fast forwarding to, let's get to the solution. We don't need to see the problems materialize to recognize that we need to get very involved. So the reality of such monetary intervention is that it's meant to demonstrate a disposition like Mario Draghi's. We'll do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And that level of commitment is supposed to bring the psychological calm, which was lacking in recent days, certainly last week. Consider it like psyops for the stock market. The challenge, as we highlighted last week, is that you have a combination of things which aren't really well suited for monetary policy. Supply shock on the one hand, and then the demand hesitancy is, you know, people in many geographies are rethinking what their central movement is and what their public interactions are. I think one of the most interesting articles I read in the recent week was from The Economist, where it's talking about a change in the way education is done, where a lot of public school education in China is having to be done on the internet. And I thought, what this could be a significant breakthrough and shift in our thinking about how we educate, how we approach social interactions. And a part of this is positive in the sense that it'll represent an evolution and use of technology in new ways.
Well, and you mentioned last week, okay, let's say that parts of a particular phone are manufactured in China and we can't get those parts. There will be a redistribution of suppliers at some point. So like you said, call it positive, call it negative, it will be changed. But I have a question for you. We talked last week about throwing liquidity. The central bankers are Johnny One Notes. Let's just put it that way. Okay. They can only do a couple of things. They can either lower rates, even negative, or they can print money. So what does that have to do with pandemic?
Let's say it's their Johnny Two Notes, because they can influence rates and they can do QE, which is buying assets, expanding the balance sheet. And again, I just want to make sure we're clear on the fact that in between supply shocks and demand hesitancy, monetary policy really doesn't solve the unknowns of pandemic.
Right.
And again, so when people change their behavior and they're not interested in going out in public, or they pause even for a week or two, it begins to have a ripple effect. So the Fed, I think, is active now, and I think in retrospect will be excused from blame.
Let's talk about those two notes then. What else can they do using those two notes?
Yeah, because they're definitely not going to be accused of inaction or passivity in the face of a growing health crisis, even though, as we've said repeatedly last week and this week as well, money printing is not the same thing as a cure for a virus. So if things get worse, the Fed can increase their balance sheet measures. This is the second note. Lowering interest rates, they've done this week. Expanding the balance sheet would be note number two. Quantitative easing, they can take from $60 billion a month to anything that represents kind of shock and awe for the 21st century. And to be frank, if you imagine 21st century shock and awe as it relates to quantitative easing, it has echoes of Zimbabwe and Venezuela to it. So there you've played your two notes. And if it doesn't work, then I guess you can ultimately lay blame on the Trump administration's feet for not doing more on the fiscal side of the equation.
We've often talked about early 1920s Germany, the Weimar Republic. And at that time, the dollar, or in their case, it was their mark, was king to start with. And that's what we saw last week. People are starting to go to cash. But very rapidly, because of these methods, like you're talking about quantitative easing, they had their own form of quantitative easing in 1920. And the printing of money ultimately turned into what you said, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, the ultimate meltdown of cash. And so, you know, just a warning to our listeners, if you think moving to cash when things are in crisis is a good idea, that would have been a great idea back when we had a gold standard, when you were actually moving to gold when you moved to cash. At this point, you're actually moving to something that ultimately collapses after these measures are taken.
Yeah, I think a part of the scramble, the panic that we've seen into treasuries is because it is a form of cash that remains liquid. You can get in, you can get out. And so that liquidity function is really critical. You're right in pointing out the difference between cash and gold and the nature of money as it's changed through time, where if someone's moving to cash today, it is a very different proposition because you are talking about a concerted devaluation. And, you know, you look at the price of gold in a variety of currencies and you can see gold rising to all-time highs in British pounds, in yen, and in euros. At least 10 different currencies this last year. And that continues. That theme continues today. And I think the dollar will probably start to reflect that as well, with gold being at all-time highs in dollar terms without very much time having passed. And again, it's not necessarily a story of gold going up as much as it is a story of the dollar going down. When you're in a desperate situation and you're printing money, QE is on the table, and interest rates are in steep decline, lo and behold, the dollar is moving lower. So you've got cracks in the financial system, which are widening. You've got the emergency G7 meeting this week to discuss coordinated efforts, market-related, economic-related, coronavirus-related. You've got the 50 basis point drop. It's the largest decrease in rates since the fall of 2008.
Okay, so we're going to see a devaluation of the dollar at some point. Who is positioned?
It already hit the dollar. So if you're talking about investors who are flat-footed,
right.
You know, it's not just a question of who's positioned for a weaker dollar as in, you know,
a gold buyer.
Yeah, a gold buyer would be. Right. But you've got the vast majority of people who've assumed that if things are deteriorating in the rest of the world, at least the U.S. is sort of a bastion of strength from an economic standpoint, and our currency is going to be more stable. So if anything, you've got, you know, long positioning in the dollar, no one expecting a weak dollar. And yet here you've got emergency rate cuts and the dollar taking another chin. Stocks go up. Everyone's happy that an intervention occurred, but there's a price for that. There's a trade-off for everything. And a weaker dollar, again, this is unanticipated, it triggers a different series of asset liquidations. It triggers a different series of asset allocation rebalancing. And, you know, if the global economy is more at risk and yields are higher in the U.S., then people who were in dollars were asking the question, why wouldn't we see more capital flow into U.S. dollars? This would be a place where we actually see capital appreciation, higher yields, greater income.
Yeah, but could it flow out? Could it just as easily flow out as flow in? We're just used to it flowing in because the dollar's been strong.
Yeah, if the dollar weakens significantly, capital can just as easily flow out. Unwinding of global trades, the markets are going to force. At some point, you're going to see the markets throwing another tantrum, and central banks are going to be put to the wall. They're going to be pressured to do more QE. And so, yes, balance sheet expansion of the Fed. We already see this week the Bank of Japan doing that with stocks. The ECB has talked about doing that with corporate bonds on a more expanded basis. The PBOC will buy everything in the kitchen sink. And maybe, just maybe, if it's all concerted, then the currency volatility can be muted. Remember, we've got currencies which are, they only show their weakness vis-a-vis one another. So in a world of fiat currencies where everything is floating, you don't really have a gauge for which is devaluing more than another. But if they all move lower simultaneously, it might actually appear like nothing bad is occurring.
But gold is a good monitor for that, right? I mean, wouldn't gold be a good way of casting light on that? If it's rising in all currencies, that means that all the currencies are falling together.
Sure. And so if there's ever a point where we get to, you know, a technical fork in the road where gold could go up or down, where there's, you know, resistance, so to say, on a chart point, I think this is one of the things to be aware of, is that gold has some political vulnerability. I think the end game here is that the markets drive the price, and short-term manipulation will be overcome by market pricing dynamics. But you can get to these cusp events where, you know, is there enough momentum to get us beyond this point, or is it going to sell off? Going back to Volcker's comments in his memoir, he always was bothered by the signal that gold sent and wished he had done more to hammer the price in the 70s so as to not show the inflationary hand. And I think that's where, you know, I'm not trying to poo-poo the idea of owning gold. I'm just saying you should be prepared for irrational and short-term volatility. And I wouldn't be unseated from a position in gold, because ultimately we're talking about currency extinction events, and you don't want to play the volatility on the metal side.
One of the things that we've seen over the last 10 years especially, but especially maybe 8 years, 9 years since 2011, is everything's become a top-down approach. And so if you want the banks to lend money, what you do is, as the ECB or the Federal Reserve, you make money available to the banks. It seems like that's happening right now with the ECB.
Yeah, and that's been the discussion between Lagarde and her team, is, you know, targeted lending to banks, so that banks can continue to lend to small firms which are affected by the virus's economic impact. Now, again, this goes back to, how is it different this time? And does monetary policy, does it gain positive traction with this kind of a market decline? On the one hand, a supply shock, that kind of lending is not going to help anything. And if demand is reflecting a decrease in demand, or aggregate demand is reflecting a change in social behavior because of real concerns, you can lower rates and lower rates and lower rates.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not going to take my family to vacation in China or Northern Italy just because prices get cheaper or rates are lower or whatever. I mean, there comes a point where you have to say, yeah, but I'm a human being and I don't necessarily want to put myself at risk, so I'm not going out today. That may be overblown in the environment today. We're not at a real critical point in the U.S. in terms of this being a, you know, grand scale crisis. But what you're looking at is the economic impact of changed behavior. And what I'm saying is that monetary policy doesn't affect either of those two factors.
Do you remember when monetary policy did? Just like 2-3 weeks ago, we were in the days of complacency, the days of wine and roses. The monetary policy solved everything. Yeah, we heard a little bit about coronavirus, but it really wasn't a concern. Look how much difference a couple of weeks make. Last week you brought up how you have Greek debt lower than U.S. Treasury debt. That shifted just since the last commentary.
Do you remember The Days of Wine and Roses, that movie? My mom mentioned to me one time that was one of her favorite movies, and I was like, oh, I got to watch that sometime. And I watched it, and it's basically about how two people destroy their lives becoming alcoholics. I'm like, what in the world?
Well, I haven't seen the movie, so I used it here on the commentary, and I've only played the song on my trumpet.
Okay, well, I mean, I wondered if maybe I got the title wrong, or if my mom has sort of a nuanced appreciation for, like, themes of what goes into healthy or unhealthy relationships, and she was kind of looking at it from a psychological. I never have understood. I need to have lunch with my mom and have her unpack that. Why?
I was just thinking of the song. Okay. I mean, Dave, the days of wine and roses, you know.
Well, back to the issue of commercial and corporate enterprises. They'll get some benefit from the ECB coming in and buying bonds, because that's the other big change that the ECB is talking about. Government bond purchases are a given, but they might expand the list maybe to include anyone and everything in the corporate sector.
Buy it all.
Yeah.
Just buy it all.
And again, that's really good relief for corporations who might need to refinance or might need a little liquidity, but it's still not going to drive aggregate demand. So there's some issues there in terms of seeing monetary policy flow through to, you know, a real positive economic impact. The fixed income markets, you remember we talked about Greek debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
last week,
that
it was still lower than U.S. Treasuries.
Yeah.
That shifted.
This is insane. It doesn't reflect reality. And the beautiful thing is that the market does fix these things eventually. Those prices flipped. The yields flipped. We were at 91 basis points on Greek debt and U.S. Treasury 10 years, same duration, same maturity, about 130. Now, all of a sudden, you've got about 130 on Greek debt. And 109, 112 is where the U.S. 10-year Treasury is fluctuating. We're off the lows by a few basis points. But it seems like the market is moving interest rates towards zero.
What do they call that? There's a fancy name. They don't call it zero. We talked about that the other day.
The effective lower bound.
Yeah, the effective lower bound. Yeah, not zero.
Yeah.
The effective lower bound.
The beauty of all of these like fancy words is that, you know, you're sitting around a cocktail party eating, what do they call them, canapés and sipping on champagne. And you're not talking about zero rates. That would be far too... it's for the hoi polloi. But the effective lower bound. We're doing to manage rates near the effective lower bound.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about canapés, okay? And I don't even know how you say it, but we were doing a wine tasting and our son was with us, and they weren't canapés to him. They were dinner. And so he finished them all while we were supposed to be matching, you know, this food with that wine. And it's my wife looked down and she says, we called them canapés, okay? But you call them canapés. Whatever it is, it's still, to me, okay, the effective lower bound, maybe I'm a PBR drinker, but, you know, just maybe low brow. But to me, it's zero, and that means nothing.
Well, low and brow. That would be just as good. You go for the PBR, I'll go for the low and brow. But I think, you know, if you note that the Fed funds rate moved this week, but it was not the prime mover. And I think this is one of the important things that you just in sort of the history of market movements and market prices, what moved first? The interest rate markets driven by market participants, or was it driven by the Federal Reserve? And in fact, the Federal Reserve is playing catch up. The markets repriced interest rates all across the curve. And now you've got the Fed funds rate that's playing catch up. Markets reprice, Fed's moving rates to a level that reflects the current fixed income pricing. And to me, this is encouraging because it says, yes, market dynamics are alive. Market participants ultimately drive prices. And so regardless of short-term manipulations or the belief that the central banks can move everything, it's actually not the case.
Well,
which means as investors, we actually still get to engage rationally. There may be periods of irrationality, but in the end, the math still has to work.
And the math on the credit default swaps, which is just the cost of insuring on these markets, there's popping way up. At this point, insurance is pretty expensive.
It was moving higher. I mean, it's nowhere near the levels it was in 2008 or 2009.
Okay.
But if you look at investment grade corporate credit default swaps, you had the largest weekly gains last week since 2011. And
there's that number again, 2011.
Yeah. Yep. And high yield saw default insurance costs increase, and the financials also finally saw a jump in CDS pricing. So it seems like the moves in the financials were a lot, but it's only because they were off such an incredibly low base. And many of the figures that we were seeing just in the week before, okay, so last week is, we're just bleeding, right? But the week before, you had credit default swaps basically priced where they were in 2007 at the lows.
That's why I say people were complacent 2 weeks ago.
Oh, absolutely. And imagine that. The efficient markets not pricing something in.
How does that happen?
Exactly.
How has that happened now for 9 years?
But I think the efficient markets are really just kind of a side name for the stupid markets, because there were the treasury markets and the gold market, which has been pricing in dislocation for weeks. Mm-hmm. And we had treasuries on the move. And then, of course, they just moved to even lower lows in terms of the yield, higher highs in terms of the price. And, you know, there's a difference between safe haven buying, which has been happening in the weeks leading up to it, mm-hmm. and panic buying, which is what we saw this last Friday. Panic buying in the treasury market was on display.
Let me ask you, though. Some of these bonds in some of these countries, remember you mentioned Argentina a few weeks ago having 100-year bonds, and we just laughed because you really don't even want to buy a bond for a week in Argentina, much less 100-year maturity.
Yeah, I mean, this is the funny thing. You've got pension funds and insurance companies, and they're quote-unquote long-term investors. So they say to themselves, look, we're trying to manage cash outflows, and we're going to maximize our current income off of this debt. And we're going to be around because we're not an individual person. We are an entity with a longer life. We will, because of our perpetuity mandate, be able to invest in things that span beyond the normal lifetime. So insurance companies and pension funds loaded the boat with 100-year Argentinian bonds. Mm. And last week, the Argentine CDS credit default swaps were up 700 basis points, priced at 4,895 basis points. And again, that's what it's now costing to insure against default on Argentinian debt. And those 100-year bonds that we talked about trade, if I'm not mistaken, right around 43 cents on the dollar.
Yes, because when interest rates rise, the principal value of the bond, what does it do?
Oh, it goes down. But, you know, so last week, volatility all over the place, Costa Rica jumped. This is credit default swaps again, 49 basis points to 300. And then you had yields, if you're looking at your emerging markets and developing countries, significantly higher. Turkey, Russia, Indonesia, South Africa, Mexico, Colombia, rise in yields. And again, when you see a rise in yields, you're talking about a tightening of financial conditions in those places.
Let's look at this a little closer to home. You have a lot of internal meetings with managers here, you know, at McIlvaney, Lila, Doug, Robert, and you guys have got to be talking about the volatility. What are the impacts of some of these unwinds, like the carry trade unwinds? What have you guys been talking about?
Well, the energy in the year is certainly like 2008 and 2009, in the sense that there's so many things happening so fast, and the interrelations between the markets are very intriguing. So having a matrix to work off of and look at the interactions is very helpful. And in this week's internal meetings, we discussed extreme volatility in the markets in both directions. Last week, we could see the implications of carry trade dynamics, leverage speculation, and then ultimately the unwind of hedge funds and their bets, which were hitting all asset classes, including gold. Mm-hmm. So a part of the gold sell-off last week was, you know, you've got risk parity strategies under pressure and gold selling off in an environment where liquidity is paramount and margin calls are proliferating. And you've got an unwind of carry trades. Remember, I talked about the increase in rates for Turkey, Russia, Indonesia, South Africa, Mexico, and Colombia. Well, on the other hand, you've got, again, it's sort of an unwind, a selling off of those assets, selling off of debt and an increase in yields, and a repurchasing of the currencies in which you originally borrowed. So again, carry trade dynamics and unwinding of carry trades. Again, that's just very simply where you borrow in a currency with low yields and invest in higher yielding currencies elsewhere around the globe. And that's the drama that we were watching.
Carry trades are interesting because it's hard enough to be right on one aspect of the market, whether it's going up or down. But a carry trade forces people to be right on two aspects at once. One is the currency. Two is the investment direction. And so carry trades, they're fine. They give you an awful lot of leverage when they're working.
And three, timing. So you've got three things that you got to get right. The currency differentials, the interest rate trends, and the timing of the trade.
Do you remember when Barings Bank, the oldest bank in England, or one of them, went under because a carry trade went wrong in Asia?
It was considered the sixth great power.
Yeah.
They considered Barings to be the equivalent in terms of power and influence as a significant nation.
But it was one guy
financial
in Barings,
decision.
And he just made the wrong bet at the wrong time.
Well, and Doug said this about the carry trades. He said, over recent years, carry trades, along with similar derivative strategies, have proliferated globally. Japanese yen and euro, with low negative interest rates, are popular, quote-unquote, funding currencies. Mm-hmm. Speculators short these currencies, and they use the proceeds to lever in higher-yielding bonds around the world. Especially Thursday and Friday, there was evidence of a serious de-risking, deleveraging, illiquidity episode. The yen jumped 3.5% last week, and the euro gained 1.7% versus the dollar as losses on popular carry trades rapidly escalated. Currency declines versus the yen included 7.4% for the Russian ruble, South African rand, and Colombian peso. The Indonesian rupee lost 7.1%, and the Mexican peso fell 7%. So again, you're talking about an unwind of leveraged trades, and so gold gets caught in the middle here,
sure,
where it's in an environment of illiquidity, and people need to raise cash, and so it gets implicated in the short run.
One of the positive aspects of why gold is going down is that it is so doggone liquid. You know, if you think about it, people don't sell their house when they need to raise liquidity. They don't sell stocks or a lot of times these margined accounts. They have to keep them going or they lose their shirt. So they'll sell gold or cash.
We had one Wall Street firm contact us last week to say, hey, we need to liquidate a gold position. And it's the only position that we still have a profit in.
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, the rationale was we can take a gain here. We've got instant liquidity and now we can go either buy other assets that are cheaper today or just, you know, reserve those cash positions or whatnot. So yeah, a lot of people asked why gold got caught up in the maelstrom and on Friday dipped in price so much. And I thought Bill King, who's, you know, he's a veteran trader, his comments were very apropos. He said gold plunged like it usually does when equities tank. On liquidity crunch, liquidation by hedge funds, investors, and foreign holders, as well as the regular month-end manipulation by gold shorts. When margin calls come, you must sell something. Some have to sell most everything. Some will sell the vehicle that still has gains when the crunch appears. This occurred in the fourth quarter of 2008, in October of 1987, and in the first quarter of 2000.
I remember all three of those dates, and gold went down while people were trying to make liquid their positions, but it was very short-lived. I mean, it doesn't last long. People come back in, buy gold, because they realize that's one of the only safe hedges that they have.
And it's just periods of time, right? That one time slice, you've got leveraged bets that are in play, you ought to meet margin calls, and you haven't changed anything in your game plan. And then there does come a point where strategic course shifts, and in the face of worsening market conditions, all of a sudden gold, which was the go-to for liquidity, all of a sudden you go back to it because you're not sure whether it's from counterparty concerns or whatnot. I thought it was very interesting. Here, at the beginning of this week, Goldman Sachs raised its gold forecast to 1,800 for the year.
Oh, well, good for them. Goldman Sachs now says it's going to be 1,800. You know, they normally trash talk gold, so not bad.
I'm sure they're not talking their book. But fascinating week this week. Again, you know, where does Monday open up? You mentioned the buying of Japanese equities before the Monday market open here in the U.S. And we actually had U.S. stocks down 2% overnight. This is Sunday night. And then we finish Monday at up between 4% and 5%. So about call it a 7-point swing, a 7 percentage point swing. It's massive, massive volatility.
In dollars, just like what we're talking about with gold in dollars. But we've been training clients for years to measure in other things. You talk about the Dow gold ratio.
Well, and I think like Doug was pointing out that there's really a bigger issue in play here. Stock market volatility is very interesting to look at from a symptomatic standpoint of what is going on within the financial system and how do people feel about the financial system. But the more important aspects are within the world of derivatives and leveraged speculation, where, again, you've got a tremendous amount. We're talking tens of trillions of dollars in play and very little shifts in terms of calibration can mean insolvency for a variety of firms. And I think that's really what you see when the Fed comes in and starts lowering rates, or when they do, and I think that it's inevitable that they will continue to expand their balance sheet. It's their effort to resolve liquidity and solvency issues within the financial system. Stocks end up being less important than the healthy functioning of the liquidity plumbing.
Going back to the Dow gold ratio, however, if you really look at the difference in where the Dow was relative to gold versus relative to the dollar, we're seeing a far better indication of what's really going on.
This is definitely a mind twister, but I think it's worth going through the exercise because, yeah, well, first of all, I want to say gold has done very well, not only finishing 2019 positive at new all-time highs in a variety of global currencies. That in itself is a very interesting story. But the Dow gold ratio is also an interesting story. So in answer to the question that people asked us earlier this week, you know, how could gold get caught up in this maelstrom? How did it go down along with the stock market? Well, in fact, if you're looking at the ratio, gold did just fine. Vis-a-vis stocks, gold improved its position and improved your purchasing power by over 16%. We went from 18.75 on the Dow gold ratio to 15.75 on the Dow gold ratio. I think we're currently at about 16.65. So seeing an increase in purchasing power is compelling. What we want to see ultimately is an increase of purchasing power, not just in a few percentage terms, but 6, 9, even 18 times the shares which we think you'll be able to purchase as gold bumps up, and we get to bear market targets. The market goes lower.
You're always thinking in terms of compounding something of reality, not currency that they can print out of thin air, but compounding real things with more real things, be it stocks, be it gold, whatever. You want to end up with a lot more of something that's not printable.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think in terms of the expansion of shares and the increase more than the increase in the quantity of dollars, right? But ultimately, if I can generate more shares, and these are, you know, companies that have a history of generating dividends, then I'm also increasing cash flow or an increase in the flow of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so if I had a 4 to 6% dividend payment, but in the future own 6 times or 9 times or 18 times the shares I would have otherwise, I stand to benefit not only on the income front, but as I also stand to benefit from the long-term capital appreciation front. So I'd say if I can increase my financial footprint by 6 times, by 9 times, or by 18 times in a life cycle, then number one, it's worth the wait. Number two, there is a huge benefit to seeing the investment game through a different lens.
So your dad started the firm back in 1972, and it was primarily gold. Okay. Gold, silver, platinum, palladium. And when you came in, you had done your stock brokering episode and spent some time out there, and you said, you know, Dad, where is this money going to flow when we see this compounding of shares? And so wasn't it about 2008 that you started the other side of the equation, let's say, to where we start looking at how do we compound ultimately from what gold will buy?
Yeah, the conversation started in 2004 and 5, and putting the groundwork in place, we started managing money in 2008. And what we wanted was kind of a combination of the offensive coordinator, responsible for putting points on the board, to complement what was already there, which had been started, as you mentioned, in 72, the defensive coordinator. We tend to see gold and silver and the precious metals complex as sort of an insurance offering. So the defensive coordinator for a football team, if you will, and the offensive coordinator, you know, both have a place on the field at a particular point in time. And our approach is definitely different on the wealth generation side, on the growth side. So we're still interested in real assets. We're still interested in real wealth. And so focusing on tangible assets like infrastructure, global natural resources, even precious metals to a degree, at least the companies that mine it, and especially real estate, it's all real stuff with cash flow.
2008, 2009 were interesting years to enter that market because most people were losing their shirts in the stock market. I think you guys made money at that time.
Yeah, volatile for 2008 and 2009. For most of the investment universe, we made money in both years. And between now and then, the team has expanded, the offerings have been refined, and from the perch we sit on, there is today an even more dynamic mix of real assets that fit the world in its current evolutionary form and make sense going forward. So whether it's driven by demographic trends or technological shifts, or for us, considering sort of the rapid expansion of central bank craziness and its impact, and not only on market psychology and asset prices, but also the impact on the value of underlying currencies, we feel we're very well positioned. So investing in the present tense is not for the faint of heart. Certainly, it's not for the autopilot indexer, which has been so popular over the last 6, 7, 8, 10 years. But on the horizon, we see the greatest shift in asset values in 40 years. I say, well, it's actually 38 years, because here we go back to that conversation of the Dow Gold ratio. As the ratio reverts, so the buying power of real money increases exponentially. And I think it's appropriate with the passing of Jack Welch this week, longtime CEO of General Electric. For those of you who've listened to the commentary for a decade or more, I've drawn out the GE example before.
Right.
But it's,
I love the example. You have to think it through, though.
It was a real example because I was there at the Ritz-Carlton in Pasadena and was running the numbers and made an investment decision myself on the basis of this ratio.
I remember the call. I remember the call. Didn't you call me and say, I'm going to be picking up, what was it, 100 ounces of gold?
That's right. And I basically split it between Canadian Maple Leafs, Krugerrands, and American Eagles.
Yeah, you were still at Morgan Stanley at that time.
Yeah, I worked at Morgan Stanley in 2001. And that was the year that Jack Welch retired from the company. And he had transformed an industrial giant into a very complicated, leveraged financial behemoth. It did a little bit of everything. And I'm not sure it did anything very well at that point. And in fact, they're still struggling to sort of come to the world with a clear identity. But through the 90s, it worked very well. You know, not only an increase in leverage, but complexity was no issue. And so shareholders benefited throughout the 1990s. I'd say shareholders have benefited a lot less in the decades since.
What made you make the decision back at that time?
We had an opportunity to go to the Ritz-Carlton. There was a missed quarter on earnings was the motivation to gather at the Ritz-Carlton in Pasadena. I think it's changed ownership. It's no longer called the Ritz-Carlton there. It's a little bit of a piece of history from Pasadena, California. A few of the largest shareholders lived in that area, and they were going to be present with questions to pose to the visiting executive coterie. They were there to kind of explain why the numbers weren't so bad.
What were the share prices back then?
GE sold for about $60 a share. And so my conundrum at the time was, you know, I had always discounted my dad's views on gold and was working in Wall Street and rather enjoying it and was concerned a little bit. I mean, we'd seen Sun Microsystems and a few other high-flying tech companies already kind of start to hit the skids. And at the time, I chose to invest a modest $30,000 in gold. And that was saying no to the inflated GE shares. $60, the executives were there to say it's 60 going to 100, we'll be fine. Any setback in price is temporary in nature.
Okay, so you invested in 100 ounces of gold. I remember that. That's about 30,000 bucks at the time
because
gold was 300 bucks. Yeah.
Yep.
Or you could have purchased at that same time had you have been convinced that GE was the better investment. 500 shares at $60 a share.
Yep. So I think this demonstrates the power of the ratio well by showing what has happened in the interim. I could reinvest dividends in those GE shares, 500 shares, and grow that position over time. And I think it would probably take me 7 generations, maybe even 10 generations to grow in this way. And I think basically the ratios, what they do for an investor is that they compress time, 7 to 10 generations worth of growth. If you're willing to wait and not wonder what is happening for you in the next quarter, the next week, even the next year, in this case, it's taken 2 decades.
You can compound. That's the word that we use all the time.
Yeah. And expand your financial footprint fairly significantly. So this, again, GE illustrates how the ratio expands your financial footprint. As someone once said, and you mentioned earlier, there are decades where nothing happens. and weeks where decades happen. And so it is with ratios, like the Dow gold ratio. Again, GE illustrates the multiplier effect.
Okay, so the GE, this is the GE gold ratio that you're personalizing at this point. So GE shares have fallen in value in dollars right now.
They've fallen from $60 to approximately $10. I'm going to keep the math simple at 10, 11, 20. They dipped last Friday to $10. So we'll just use that as a number. It's easy math. Fell from 60 to 10. That's about an 80% loss, a little bit over 80% loss over a 20-year period.
In dollars.
Yep. Gold has increased from 300 to 1600 an ounce, over a 500% gain. Now, certainly, if you had sold GE shares at $60 and just sat out the decline of 80%, sat in cash and went out and bought more shares today, you'd be better off. Because instead of your 500 shares, a move to cash and then a repurchase of shares would bring you to, at current prices, 3,000 shares.
And that's not bad.
No, not bad at all. But combine the math, take both sides of the ratio, and this is where you begin to see real power, because you can own 16,000 shares instead of the 500 original, or instead of the 3,000 that you would have had just moving to cash. That's a 32 times increase. A 32 times increase in shares versus just the 6 times you would have had selling and buying back at lower prices. So, I mean, this is compelling to me, because to reinvest dividends, again, how many generations does it take of reinvesting dividends to turn your 500 shares into 16,000 shares? But if I wanted to today, right now, sell those 100 ounces of gold, I can go buy pert near 16,000 shares of GE.
Wow, instead of the original 500.
Yeah. Now, suppose GE goes back to paying a healthy quarterly dividend. You know, they're still under pressure from a financial standpoint, reorganization, not like chapter whatever reorganization, but they're trying to figure out what the soul of the corporation is. And email leaves, and they've got a new CEO trying to fix things up again. So you've got the dividend at what, a penny a quarter. But going back to 1941, the average quarterly dividend for General Electric shares is 44 cents a share. We go back to the average, those 16,000 shares would now generate $28,000 a year in income.
Hmm. And you started with 30,000 is what you're saying. And so you're talking the dividend alone would, in 1 year, would be what the original investment was.
And of course, it doesn't do that today because the dividends have fallen off.
Yeah.
But assuming that GE has a place in the future and isn't joining sort of the dustbin of history, it is the last of the Dow original Dow components. 125 years on, there is only one Dow Jones industrial stock that was in the original list of 10, and then it became 30, and it still is the only one there. But should it survive? Should it to any degree revive? Which I think it can. I mean, look, they generate between $95 and $100 billion in annual revenue now. So they do have something to work with to reshape and remold. Then I think the ratio exchange will have done its job and multiplied the financial footprint. So I look at this week, these 2 weeks, this period of volatility, and it's cracked psychology in the marketplace. And it has people asking a different set of questions. I hope they're not asking, should I be backing up the truck and buying stocks right now because they're a 10% discount off of all-time highs? And, oh, I missed the opportunity because did you see the huge run on Monday? I knew I should have stayed in and just stayed the course. Stocks for the long run, Jeremy Siegel, the man of the hour, the man of the century, should keep our feet to the fire and keep us invested forever. No, in fact, if you're willing to strategically engage with your portfolio, there's periods of time where hard assets make so much sense. So much sense. And where gold as an insurance play represents your means of not only opting out of the system, which may go through a period of chaos and turmoil, but it allows you to re-engage that same system on your own terms and in the right time. And that's where, again, increasing your financial footprint is so powerful. I think it goes without saying that we're moving into a period where central banks do nothing but monetize assets, right? And this is where real crisis begins to dawn on the average investor, not just a few who are over leveraged, you know, in a fund and forced to liquidate last week. But this is one of the reasons why I love gold for the long term, because it reflects the realities of where we're going in terms of central bank monetary policy, in terms of fiscal policy. And ultimately, if you're playing the value equation and playing the ratios, you're still on the right side of the trade. It's 16 to 1. Classically, we get to a 1 to 1 at an extreme. A 2 to 1 is highly probable. A 3 to 1 is where you always go on the basis of economics without any either political or geopolitical complication. That, of course, those political and geopolitical complications are how you get the Dow gold ratio to a 2 or a 1 to 1 ratio. But 3 to 1, 2 to 1, 1 to 1, you know, our friend at Cross Currents likes to say 5 to 1 is the average. You can count on that. Take that to the bank. Well, again, bare minimum, you can increase your financial footprint by 3 times. A 300% gain in your ownership of shares if you play the Dow gold ratio just starting now and exiting at a 5-to-1 ratio. But a 3-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1 are clearly possible. And I think that's what we're playing for, is a massive increase in real wealth as it's reflected in a variety of asset classes. So I guess to conclude, there are things that you can do. There are things that you should be doing. And most importantly, I think there's questions that you should ask and a disposition you should adopt as it relates to engaging your financial assets and engaging your long-term financial goals. Coronavirus, yes, it's a concern. Yes, we'll see melt-ups and meltdowns. We'll continue to see volatility. We'll continue to see market interventions from the Fed, from the ECB, from your various central bankers. But what is your game plan? What is your strategy? If that's not clear enough in your mind yet, I would encourage you to work that out. Work it out on paper. Call us and we'll help you work it out on paper. And so there are things that you should be doing. My attitude towards the markets is a little bit like my attitude towards coronavirus. I'm not inclined to shut myself in. I'm inclined to figure out what the best strategy is. If there's some practical things that can be done, then by all means, we'll get that done. But not to live in fear or panic, just to make sure you're implementing an excellent and well-thought-out plan.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.